Hello and a very warm welcome to the Sound of Economics Bruegel's podcast. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and today I'm pleased to host Johan van Overtveld, who is currently the chair of the budget committee in the European Parliament and was finance minister of Belgium during 2014 to 17. And who is also an economist, and he worked on a variety of topics. But today he's here also as part of our series of discussions with senior European parliamentarians. So we want to hear from him what are the key issues discussed in the budget committee, where he sees the biggest debates at the moment. But we also want to spend some time on central banking. Central banking has become very interesting, was always interesting, but now is again an interesting moment because of the rise of inflation, obviously. And Johan van Overtveld is about to publish a book called The Mystic Hand, How Central Banks Shape the 21st Century Global Economy, in which he also tells his perception of central banking and his conversations that he has had an opportunity to have during his time as a finance minister and perhaps also later. So we want to talk really about those two things, the budget committee, his work in the budget committee, and the central banking. Last word of introduction on my end, Johan is also, in terms of party affiliation, he is a member of the European Conservative and Reform Group. So without much further ado, Johan, perhaps we start with that, really about the budget committee and the big issues being discussed there. And one of the big issues is, of course, own resources and how to mobilize funds to essentially pay back the borrowing, the next generation EU borrowing. Where is this debate and where do you see it going?
Thank you, Wolfram, first of all, for having me. And indeed, like you correctly pointed out, the discussion on the next generation EU, on the recovery and resilience facility, on the own resources needed to repay this huge fund of 750 billion rounded numbers. It is all about today in the budget committee, but not only in the budget committee, also in several other committees, this discussion is very much to the point. Where are we going? Well, there are several main discussion points, but according to me, the most difficult discussion point is on the own resources. We have the ETS system, we have the cross-border carbon tax, several other ideas floating around. Not all member states are on the same wavelength, far from it. But we have to find these own resources. Otherwise, the repayment of the NGEU debt will eat into existing programs. And that, of course, is a recipe for another very heated political debate or political difficulties even. So we have to solve this in a transparent and constructive way. It's an ongoing discussion with the Council, with the Commission, and of course also with the Parliament, first of all through the Budget Committee. We're absolutely not yet there. Several ideas are on the table, and it will take months of intensive work and consultation, maybe sometimes even confrontation. It's politics, you know, to get where we have to be in order to serve in the best way the European citizens.
So just to push you a little bit on this, I mean, you said the alternative to own resources would be cutting into other spending. Well, fair enough, but the alternative would be, of course, bigger national contributions to the EU budget, or even not paying back the debt and postponing the debt payback to further in the future. I know it's, of course, not the line of the European Council. The European Council said the debt has to be paid back. But in secret, don't the majority of politicians believe that this is what is going to happen? I mean, politicians like to postpone paying back debt.
Well, maybe you are a mind reader, Wolfram, because the two possible ways out of it are two things I've been thinking about myself also. Although I have to say that they certainly are not officially on whatever agenda within the European institutions. But of course, increasing the national contribution is theoretically, of course, a possibility. Although with respect to that, political difficulties amongst the member states, each other are tremendous. And it would really think if you open that discussion, it's really a Pandora's box that you open. So nobody is anxious to do that. Where the sensitivities may be somewhat different is on the postponement. Let's summarize it with that word, which is, of course, something that is always attractive to, or most of the time attractive to, a lot of politicians. Let me phrase it in that way. Of course, in an environment of very low interest rates, it's more easy to discuss that or to contemplate that than in an environment of higher interest rates, where, of course, then you have to calculate with, obviously, interest rates to be paid the higher sum also. So they're not on the table. The two additional venues that you outlined, are people thinking of it? I would be very surprised if people were not thinking about it. And then especially on possible postponement, although don't forget, we are already in 54 or something before the end of the repayment. So we are already a very long period to look at. But that is certainly something, if we can't solve the issue, that will automatically come on the table.
Can you give us a sense of divisions or different views from different party groups? I mean, you're chairing the committee, and of course, as a chair, you have to try to bring the various different opinions together. And, you know, traditionally, there's always, of course, the different country views on these budgetary issues, which are very well known. But what about party differences?
Well, you're right to indicate that there might be some discrepancy between what is happening at the party level and certainly the European party level on the one hand and what is happening in individual member states. But, you know, Wolfram, I am chairman of the budget committee, so I have also a lot of informal talks with my coordinators. You know, each political group has a coordinator in each committee. So Christian Democrats, Socialists, the Greens, they all have their coordinator in Budget Committee. I speak with them a lot, also off the record, so I have a sense of where it is going, but it would be irresponsible for me as a chairman to talk openly about this, because I think I can say that I have the confidence of these people.
Of course.
I don't want to infringe on that the confidence, and so I know very well where the sensitivities are, where the different groups are heading at this moment. That may change over time, but I would really not like to talk about that in public. That would not be good chairmanship if I would do that. And I think you understand and respect that.
I understand, of course, but it was still worth trying to get an answer. So let's move perhaps beyond the budget committee to your book on how central banks shape the 21st century global economy. So give us your main pitch. I mean, what's the story of this book?
Okay. I take an historical perspective. The Great Depression of the 1930s of the last century came about because central banks didn't take their job as lenders of last resort seriously. When the financial crisis started to brew in 2007, under the, I dare say, leadership of Ben Bernanke, central banks realized that they could not make the same mistake twice. And so they intervened, and they intervened a lot in what I would describe as a courageous and creative way. They did the same when all of a sudden in 2020, the pandemic fell on our back. What they did wrong, according to me, and I dare say that aloud because I've been saying this for years already now, that they continued on this policy path, very low interest rates and intensive asset buying programs for too long, especially after the financial crisis. And that had several consequences, not least the fact that the policy room that they had at their disposal was limited because they stayed on the track of very low interest rates and very massive asset buying programs, the so-called QE programs. But also, this way of conducting monetary policy had a lot of unintended consequences, and unfortunately, a lot of them on the negative side. The attack on that kind of policy was on the savings, the smaller savings of the, let's say, ordinary people. For example, in Belgium, there is more than 300 billion euros in saving accounts. The loss of purchasing power of the money in that saving account over the past 10 years is at least 20%, which is a lot. Then you have the fact that these policies, and I know central banks tried to counter it, but of course, the power of these very low interest rates was too great, ever increasing leverage and debt levels. You kept zombie companies alive, often through zombie banks. One thing of these unintended consequences that for me is very important because I lived it as a politician is that it sent the wrong incentives to the political world. Why bother with difficult reforms, electorally often non-rewarding reforms to stimulate economic growth and job creation, if central banks continuously send the message, we can do it and we can do even more? I heard that a lot during my time in the Belgian government. And so overall, they've been courageous and creative during the crisis moments. They kept on the path too long. And now we're in a situation where the policy space is practically zero, where inflation is flashing up quite unexpectedly and quite impressively. And so important choices will have to be made in the literally coming weeks and months.
Thanks for putting up this thesis. So let's try to unpack it and sort of push you on the various points. I think the first point you made is that, you know, the central banks played an essential role in preventing another Great Depression. And I think it's great to hear that acknowledgement from you because, of course, at the time when central banks acted, it was far from obvious that they acted, including in the Eurozone. And, you know, there was a lot of pushback against the various programs. So I think it's great that we can agree that the lender of last resort function in a moment of high financial crisis is really essential. And the central banks did a rather good job and the ECB did a rather good job in this. Now, then your main point is, well, they continued for too long. And let's focus perhaps on the ECB. So the ECB continued for too long. The counter argument, of course, had been, well, but inflation rates did not reach the 2% or close to 2% target. On the contrary, during much of the last 10 years, actually, inflation rates were well below the 2%, more in the order of magnitude of 1%. You know, that I think also challenges your view on the losses to the savings accounts, right? Because what matters to the saver is the real return, which is the interest rate minus the inflation. And since inflation was quite low, the interest rate could also be much lower than usual. So I'm wondering, what's the basis of the statement that they didn't withdraw early enough? Should they have withdrawn? And when should the ECB have ended its QE program? And I'm talking here pre-pandemic. So are you thinking of 2015? Are you thinking of 2018, 19? I mean, what are we talking about really? And how would you answer the question on the inflation rate really?
Of course, very, very good remarks and very much to the point. Actually, I've never been a believer in the 2% inflation rate. What is the economic difference between 2% and 1% inflation? I think Paul Volcker, who we all know as quite a heroic Federal Reserve central banker, made the point years ago already. What do we have with this 2%? Why not 1%, for example? So that's first part of my answer. And of course, what everybody seems to forget that when you talk about inflation, you have inflation in goods and services, but you have, of course, also asset inflation. And during the last 10 years, we've had a tremendous asset inflation, whether you talk about real estate, not everywhere in every place of the world, but in large segments of the world, and certainly in the European, in the euro area and in the United States. You have, in terms of equity, let me use an understatement, a tendency to bubble blowing. You have, the, for example, the art market, which clearly had become or has become a bubble. So inflation, first of all, 2%. Why? Why not 1%? Secondly, asset inflation. And then with respect to the real returns on saving, yeah, of course, if you have only 1% or 2% inflation, but the interest rates on savings is already for years zero. So if you have cumulatively during 10 years, 1 to 2% inflation, you end up with a cumulative loss in purchasing power of those savings in the neighborhood of 20%. That would be my answers to your remarks.
Right. But I mean, the 2% in a sense was the agreed target. And Otmar Issing, the executive board member of the ECB at the time when he implemented changes to the strategy of the ECB, he operationalized the close to 2% by saying it should be between 1.7 and 1.9%, which is a relatively clear range. And I think the main justification for the 2% had always been that reaching 2% provides you policy space, because what you want to avoid is an area where inflation is close to zero, because then you have several countries that are actually in deflation because they have to adjust in relative prices to the rest of the Eurozone. And you have also lots of goods that have to basically have negative inflation. And that makes the economy just work less efficiently. So in the central banking community, it's fairly standard and fairly respected to use the 2% target for these variety of reasons. And it had been also the target that even Otmar Issing, the conservative German central banker, had committed to at the time when he was at the ECB. So, I mean, I can see that one can have a debate on changing the target. But if you have a target and you don't reach it, don't you need to try to reach it? Or are you saying the measures were not effective in reaching it? Or what's the main point you want to make here?
Well, if year after year you don't achieve your target, you should indeed question whether your target is still a suitable target given the development of the environment and the tools you have at your disposal. But I was very glad that you mentioned Otmar Issing in your remark, because you were right about operationalization of the 2%. But we both know very well that Otmar Issing was also the man who strongly pleaded to use this inflation targeting, or the 2%, in conjunction with very focused attention on monetary and credit aggregates. And the two together gave you a perfect picture where you were going with your monetary policy. And so a relatively low inflation with an evolution in the monetary and credit targets that were on the high side, let me put it that way, gave you an indication that maybe you should consider or reconsider what you were doing in terms of these monetary policies. So as far as I know, has never defended the 2% standing on its own. He always saw it together with attention for the monetary and credit aggregates. And that would have made a difference, because at several points in time, they were clearly pointing to the need to have more restrictive policy than the ones we had. And then I'm not even referring on the Taylor rule calculations. We both probably have seen a lot of them, but most of them went clearly in the direction of monetary policy that was overexpensive once the crucial points or the true tension points of the crisis moments were over.
Right. So, I mean, we don't have to agree, obviously, on these points, but it's great to exchange point of views. And that's what we want to do at Bruegel. So let's focus a bit more on the pandemic and now the more recent numbers, because I think that would be very interesting to our audience to hear your views on that. Of course, there was the immediate pandemic response where the ECB put up a very big program, the so-called PEP program, which is a pandemic emergency purchase program, which allowed the ECB really to stabilize financial markets at a very critical moment at the beginning of the pandemic, when there was a lot of nervousness in financial markets and a lot of volatility. We are now 2 years almost after the beginning of the pandemic, and I would say it's fair to say that growth is back. The output gap is looking rather closed, or it's about to close during this year. And of course, inflation numbers are now very high, much above the 2%. And if you exclude the energy prices and you just look at core inflation, it's still above 2%. Now, the ECB has started communicating about a change in course. Christine Lagarde, in her last press conference, I think, did do some expectation management, and financial markets did react to that. But still, a lot of critics are thinking on the more conservative side, or are thinking that monetary policy normalization is too slow, and they don't trust the forward guidance and the fact that inflation is projected to be below 2%. I mean, the Commission, for example, European Commission, in its forecast came out with the projection of inflation below 2% next year already. So I think the debate very much is about how transitory is this inflation shock, how much underlying price pressures do we have, and you know what should monetary policy do, how quickly should it normalize, and if it normalizes more quickly, what are the consequences? So what's your take on that debate where we stand currently?
Well, first of all, Wolfman, if you have growth coming back substantially, if you have very low employment, Lagarde herself referred to that extensively in her latest press remarks, and inflation rising quite rapidly, I think you have the textbook example of a need for more restrictive monetary policy. I mean, it's hard to find a better example of this kind of macroeconomic situation. Now, of course, like Lagarde and Schnabel and a lot of other people from the ECB have correctly pointed out, of course, monetary policy will not influence energy prices. But we all know that every inflation process starts with something, whether it's crude oil prices or gas prices or electricity prices or grain prices or whatever, there is always something to ignite the fire. And, you know, I had a professor at the University of Antwerp who told us, I studied in the late 70s, early 80s. Not that I didn't study after that, but you mean as a real student. He always said to us, when do you have inflation? Well, my dear students, you have inflation when everybody talks about inflation. And that's, of course, a rudimentary way of talking about expectations. And that's the process we are in now. And I saw recently some quotes from Isabel Schnabel and a few other people of the ECB, also from Christine Lagarde. She talks about second round effects of inflation, and that has, of course, a lot to do with expectations. So what the ECB should do now is manage expectations. When I talk to corporate people, corporate managers or CEOs, they all talk about price increases. The more and the faster, the better. They tend to do that always, but it's very pronounced now. That's expectations on the verge of running wild. And that's where the ECB comes in. They need to give a signal that they will indeed act on the inflation. And I think that's the background of the remarks made very recently by Klaas Knot, the president of the Dutch Central Bank, and the new Bundesbank president, Joachim Nagel, who both are talking about an practically immediate end to net bond buying, I stress net, and rate increases already this year, which is something that indirectly Lagarde still excludes. But I think she will have to pedal back on that.
Do you think she's actually excluding it? I mean, I listened very carefully to her press statement, and honestly, markets have priced in the rate hike. So I mean, the way she managed expectations in that press conference really means there's going to be rate hikes in Q3, basically. So I think the ECB has actually shifted tremendously since December. And of course, a lot depends now on the next numbers and the March Monetary Governing Council meeting.
Yeah, well, of course, she has changed her discourse. That's certainly so. But my God, if she hadn't done that, then she would really be in trouble. But I think she's still behind the curve. And it's clearly a sign that people like Knot and Nagel are very much more pronounced and very much more precise about what will happen or what should happen according to them. So president of the ECB is changing her discourse, but she's doing it very cautiously. You will say she needs to do it. I agree, but she remains, according to me, too hesitant to really be able to manage expectations in the desired way, especially because there's something with respect to inflation that I practically don't hear in the discussion. And that's the following. We tend to say in Europe, inflation is still much lower or lower than in the United States. But don't forget that the world economy is still to a large extent on a dollar standard, whether we like it or not. So dollar inflation will influence also the European economy. And so the higher inflation in the United States will, to a certain degree, also come to Europe, whether we like it or not. And also that is part of managing expectations and making sure that people in the markets understand that you will not let that kind of inflation develop without countermeasures.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the record, I also did say in January that we need a gradual tightening and a gradual change of the discourse given the numbers. However, I also have to say I'm very much in the camp, do it gradually and do it slowly, because there is a lot of uncertainty as regards next year. We have these inflation forecasts that, by the way, it's not just by the official institutions below 2%. There's also market forecasts often also below 2%. So I mean, you don't want to also overdo it. And of course, you have to be mindful of what it means in terms of disruptions of the economy. And so I guess I would like to push you a little bit on this, how you see this gradualism argument, and perhaps also whether you think the hesitancy of the ECB or some of the hesitancy of the ECB is a result of perhaps some fiscal dominance even. I mean, is that what is behind it from your point of view, or how do you see that?
Well, with respect to the last remark on fiscal dominance, obviously that's there. If you see the reactions now, for example, in Italy and in Greece, to the first effects, the increase in spreads and things like that, it's obvious that there is a fiscal break, if you want, on what the ECB can do. And that's, of course, very problematic in terms of the independence of the ECB. And that's why I also think that the inflation fighting is more complicated for the ECB than for the Federal Reserve, for example. But price stability is the crucial element in the mission of the ECB, so they should take it seriously. And according to my humble opinion, I think the end to net bond sales that Nagel is demanding now should already be there now. And the rate increase, it should, of course, also be gradually. I'm not pleading for 50 base points interest increases, two or three this year. But we really need to get out of the negative interest rate era. That's, I think, something we need to do quite quickly. End the net bond sales right now and start to increase interest rates in a gradual way, at least by the summer or at the latest.
All right. I'm sure that different people will have different views on this. But of course, it's great to hear that view from you and get that perspective. Perhaps one last question. I mean, you also talked a lot to some of the central bankers. You talked to Christine Lagarde, you talked to Mario Draghi. Tell us perhaps for our listeners the most exciting story of that conversation, I mean, and the most exciting debate you've had. Just I think this episode would be very interesting because you talk about it in the book also.
Well, if you allow me, I would refer to another discussion I had already many years ago before my time in politics. And that discussion was with Paul Volcker, who at that time was already in his 80s, but still very alert to what was happening in the world. And I asked him the question, what, according to you, Mr. Volcker, is central about or crucial about central banking? And you know, Volcker was a huge man, 2 meters and something, always a cigar in his mouth. And he looked at me while smoking his cigar. He said, well, my friend, I'm going to say to you what I said 10 or 20 years ago to Mervyn King of the Bank of England. Central bank is all about mystique. And that's why the title of my book comes from, because he emphasized that very much. He was very serious about it too. So that's the most striking part of a conversation I ever had with a central banker.
Johan van Overtveld, thank you so much for the conversation. It was really great to discuss with you both about your current role in the budget committee, but also about your perceptions and discussions with the central banking community. And thank you to our listeners for listening in to this Bruegel podcast. This was a special edition with a senior member of European Parliament. Please join us again. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please go on your social media feed and promote it. Thank you so much, and until next time, bye-bye.